Welcome. This is the Contreras Report. I am Raul Lowry Contreras, and we're going to talk about Business Mexico today. Thank you, first of all, for being there. Let's see. We're going to talk about Mexico using a new national campaign to try to pull businesses out of China to Mexico. President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, AMLO, contradicts campaign for attracting business from China. And we'll discuss that in greater detail. The American brewery Constellation Brands in Mexicali that AMLO shut down by using a phony plebiscite to say the people didn't want it. Well, that issue is coming to the surface again. AMLO, the president, is accusing his two predecessors, Calderon and Peña Nieto, of corruption and demands that they testify in a criminal trial going on now for the former president of Pemex. And we wonder if this is a coincidence. He's calling President Calderon's 6 years in office from 2006 to 2012 a narco state. Now, is this all a coincidence because, as one prominent Mexican says, the president of Mexico is making these charges of corruption through his predecessors because of his failure in helping the Mexican Republic survive the pandemic? Mexico is now number 3 in the number of deaths in the entire world. Now, some good news. There is an Indian tribe in northern Mexico in the state of Sonora, which is right next to Arizona, called the Yaqui Indians. And they, according to my research over the years, have never been defeated by the United States of America or the United States of Mexico. They're rising up again, and so we shall see what we shall see. Speaking of Indians, the Maya train goes electric. We'll discuss the Maya train, named after the Mayas of the Yucatan Peninsula in Guatemala. Speaking of Yucatan, the state of Yucatan is dry. That is to say, liquor is prohibited from sale. And that prohibition has been extended, and it's because of the pandemic. Quintana Roo, which is a state that shares the Yucatan Peninsula with the state of Yucatan, it's starting to open up this in the next few days. And we're, you know, suggesting that's called the Mexican Riviera. We're called Playa Carmen and Tulum and Isla Mujeres. This is very, very important. And we're going to wind up today with some more history from Mexico, the Spanish colonial era. Okay, here we go. And again, thank you for being there. The Republic of Mexico is set on a new path, and that is it's trying to lure businesses that are in China out of China and to come to Mexico. Not necessarily just to build a plant or a branch, but to pull the whole business out. And the reason is that supply chains, particularly for the automotive industry, have grown so large and so important in Mexico in the past 20 years that, for example, the United States auto industry probably wouldn't even exist today if it wasn't the supply chains that were built up in Mexico to supply the Mexican automobile industry and the American automobile industry and the smaller but important automobile industry in Canada. This supply chain that stretches from Mexico to Canada is extremely important, and it's the best auto supply chain now in the world. It supplies the automobile industry in 3 countries. The NAFTA countries. Remember NAFTA? It's still in effect. It's not called the USMCA, but it's still the same thing. They made a few minor changes, because President Trump was totally wrong on NAFTA. Totally, completely wrong. Oh, it made good politics in places like Wisconsin and Michigan that had lost some jobs to Mexico, some jobs. Yet Michigan still exports $12 billion worth of automobiles and automobile parts to Mexico. $12 billion with a B dollars, okay? Wisconsin sells more to Mexico than it buys. Remember that. Okay, now, with the pandemic having started in China, it hit China the hardest first, which caused a shutdown of a lot of business there. And its GDP, gross domestic product, dropped 10% during the shutdown. Mexico is rising to the challenge with NAFTA 2.0 in effect. It's working hard to pull companies out of China and to bring them to Mexico. Mexico calls it relocation strategy. You know what those two words mean to me? Some Harvard MBA that Mexican companies have hired have come up with this relocation strategy. Because that's what Harvard MBAs do. They come up with clever names for actions that may or may not make sense. In this case, makes terrific sense. The relations, and here's what makes it work. The relations between Mexico and the U.S. have never been better. And that is despite the presidencies of Donald Trump and Andrés Manuel López Obrador, both of whom are cut from the same piece of cloth, or their twin brothers with a different mother. The relations between the United States and Mexico have never been better. Remember, the NAFTA trade area, it's over $1 trillion in trade between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. $1 trillion a year and growing. There's been some movement out of China because of the pandemic as it was before. Some have complained about intellectual property problems, some businesses, and have complained about intellectual property problems, rising labor costs, and political stability. I mean, now they have a president for life. Well, you know what that means. You know what that means. And the Chinese Communist Party is still the Chinese Communist Party. They're not going to change. People like me had high hopes when Nixon opened the door to China back in 73, capitalism, free enterprise would convince the Chinese people that Chinese communism wasn't the way to go. Well, for a number of years, that was actually true as China became middle class and a manufacturing giant. Everyone like me that are concerned about foreign trade and politics thought this is it. But all of a sudden the Chinese Communist Party has intervened in that natural process and has developed an even stronger dictatorship than they had before, even more than under Mao Zedong. China was so poor and so widespread and just scattered all over the place. A lot of people just did their own thing. There's a consultant firm named Gartner that found 33% of global supply chain leaders had either shifted or something, or sourcing or manufacturing out of China, or are planning to within 3 years. That's 33%. Now, Japan and other Asian countries like the Philippines, Malaysia, and Vietnam are all working hard to pull some of these businesses to leave China and to go to their countries. But so is Mexico. Even President Trump has mentioned that the U.S. will welcome any company wishing to return to the U.S. Well, he should also say to Mexico as well. As Trump says, quote, bringing your companies home and making your products in the USA is a good thing, unquote. In 2015, China owned 20% of global manufacturing. Mexico's share of global manufacturing in 2015 was only 2%. So, even if they only double and go to 4%, that's double what they're doing now, and they're doing well now. this country, the United States, has not been flooded with illegal young men from Mexico illegally crossing the border to take jobs illegally, because they're finding decent work at home. Now, there is one huge roadblock to the success of this program: the president of Mexico. AMLO, is his dislike for private enterprise is causing foreign investment to be uncertain about investing in Mexico. And that's ridiculous, because on the one hand, you've got the government of Mexico that's trying very, very hard to bring new business to Mexico, to build up the business community. And on the other, you've got the president of Mexico who calls any free enterpriser neoliberals, like it's a nasty, nasty state of mind. This reminds me of how phony American patriots called people like me neocons, because we believe that we, the United States, should be the policeman of the world, because if it's not us, who's it going to be? 1940 Germany? 1995 Soviet Union? 2020 Iran? 2020 China? No. We're the only ones who have any morals whatsoever, and our morals aren't that good to begin with. But they're better than what we see in the rest of the world. So, in his first year, AMLO's first year as president, the foreign investment dropped 16%. That's almost one-fifth. Because they don't trust AMLO. For example, the brewery closing in Mexicali is 70% completed, $900 million spent on it, and he calls a phony plebiscite in which only 37,000 people voted, and only 20,000 voted to shut down the brewery. 20,000 people in a valley, the Mexicali Valley, that has over 1 million people. Phony plebiscite. So that's one example. Now, he's trying to crack down on private energy generation, which the previous administration had encouraged starting in 2014, to the point where half the electricity in Mexico is currently being generated by private enterprise at a cost like one-fifth of what government facilities cost or spend to produce the exact same megawatt hour of electrical energy. AMLO has set out to reverse the energy policy, and he wants to make Pemex, the national oil company, the company in Mexico to lead the way in oil. And that's ridiculous. Its bonding is called junk bonds now. They can't raise money on the market. It needs foreign partners to try to work their way out of this deep, deep hole that Pemex has gotten into, because it's a corrupt company run by the government of Mexico. Let me give you an example of what should happen. There's a company based in Los Angeles called Motor Car Parts of America. It has, in the past 2-3 years, invested $30 million in Tijuana, Mexico. I'm just sitting outside of it right this second. And has spent $30 million in building production facilities to remanufacture devices like alternators for cars, starters for cars, power brake boosters, and various parts like that. They spent years in China. The chief executive officer, Selwyn Joffe, says that he felt, quote, uncomfortable with the situation in China, unquote. Says it's still cheaper to produce in China, but stability, quote, stability and government relations seem to favor Mexico. Quote, Mexico is more expensive, but we weigh that with the accessibility of the marketplace. So if Motor Car Parts of America built an alternator in China for half the labor cost. Then they had to pack it up in a container and send it to Los Angeles and then distribute it from there. Okay? So that transportation cost pretty much eats into that difference in labor cost. But now if they're building in Tijuana, Mexico, which sits right on the border, they can take and load up an 18-wheeler truck with their product and go through the Otay Gate in a day or a few hours and be in the United States within 4 or 5 hours from their plant or whatever it takes to get through customs, which can be pretty bad some days because of so many trucks are trying to cross. But that shows how much cheaper it is because they don't have to move the product from China to the United States. They don't have to move the product from China to the United States. That's the key. Good luck to Mexico. A lot of good luck. Now, AMLO, López Obrador, the president of Mexico, is deflecting again. Now he's bringing up the Mexicali brewery situation that was 70% complete when he had his phony plebiscite to shut it down. He accuses the American company, Constellation Brands, of planning to finish the plant and start operating despite having its permits canceled after the phony plebiscite when AMLO won. After he won his election to the presidency. Voting was in March. 37,000 people voted. 76.1% voted to shut down the $1.4 billion plant. And they did so because farmers, left-wing commune farmers in the Mexicali Valley, told everybody that the brewery was going to use all their water and they weren't going to have water for crops. And that's a lie. That is a lie. $900 million has already been spent up to now on the facility. And 37,000 people voted, 20,000 voted to shut it down out of over 1 million people in the Mexicali Valley. AMLO said, the company would understand, quote unquote. But national business leader Gustavo de Hoyos of the National Business Group says, quote, production of the most famous Mexican beer in the world, Corona beer, is prohibited in Mexico. Who's going to want to invest in a country with such contradictions and absurdities? AMLO says he will not allow the American company to finish the plant. AMLO says he has heard the company will sue and take the fight to the courts. AMLO says, quote, let it be known to those in Baja California that there is no authorization. There are no permits for it, unquote. Quote, whole, while the company has worked under rules at the time, in other words, they got their permits under the existing rules, they were not correct rules, unquote. In other words, they were not AMLO's rules. He's trying to run Mexico like a one-man dictatorship. But he's trying this in the electrical generation field too, and the courts have stopped him dead. The courts have stopped this Maya Train project, which I'll discuss later, in parts of the Yucatan Peninsula for health reasons. And this is getting to be ridiculous. AMLO, get out of the way. Mexico doesn't need your stupid, restrictionist, neoliberal antagonism. Now, when AMLO called for a plebiscite, a consultation he called it, on whether or not the $1.4 billion brewery project in Mexicali should proceed, the 1 million person valley didn't vote. A handful of people voted. Over 1 million people, and just in the valley, not counting in the state. There's 3 million in the state. The Mexican Bar Association said 4 Mexican constitutional provisions are violated by the consultation, the plebiscite. Quote, this is what the Bar Association said, quote, Its results cannot be binding because that would mean that the parentheses permits, close parentheses, already issued could be revoked by a groundless participatory exercise without due process, resulting in the violation of Article 14 of the Mexican Constitution. And one should note this. The National Water Commission and Environmental Ministry of the federal government both approved the project. They both approved the project. All the permits were granted under existing rules at the time. And now AMLO's come along saying, well, the rules are different now. We're going to apply today's rules to a project that was approved several years ago. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a knife in the back of the Mexican Republic by a man who is a wannabe dictator. More proof that that AMLO López Obrador is faulty in his very presidency. He's accusing Felipe Calderón, president of Mexico from 2006 to 2012, of running a narco state. We should remember this. This shows what a petty person AMLO is. Felipe Calderón defeated. This is at the end of the Vicente Fox administration. Felipe Calderón was from the same party, the Partido Acción Nacional, PAN, P-A-N. He defeated AMLO for the presidency in 2006. Yes, it was a close election. However, there was a recount in 16,000 randomly chosen precincts, and Calderón's margin of victory, slim, but was a margin of victory. He won the presidency fair and square. And the recount showed that there was very little change in, yes, it was a close election, a little over 1%. AMLO says that his predecessor, Felipe Calderón, ran a narco state, according to accusations made by AMLO administration appointees, political appointees, against or by high-ranking Calderón appointments at the time, okay, that they were corrupt. AMLO says the information is released by U.S. authorities about former Calderón security minister Genaro García Luna, and that leads AMLO to use the term narco state. Says, quote, government had been taken over, unquote, by narcos. Note, none of this has been proven in court. So far, these are just words tossed around by a guy that's being held prisoner by the Mexican government. I'll tell you what is going on here. There's been a deal made, and they promised to not put him in jail for prison for 40 years, which is the maximum term that you can get in Mexico. And they've made a deal with him, and he is spouting off all this stuff without any proof. So far, people might remember that Calderón defeated AMLO in 2006. This is 2020, 14 years ago. It was a close election, yes. But here's what happened at the time. For those of you that don't know, Felipe Calderón became the president. AMLO, López Obrador, refused to accept the election returns. He sounds like Donald Trump is hinting that he wants to see, before he endorses the election returns, he wants to see what happens. And he's already talking about massive fraud and that's going to cost him the election. Well, López Obrador was in exactly the same boat, except when the election was held and was finalized and Calderón became president, AMLO declared himself the legitimate president of Mexico, and he appointed cabinet members and government officials at all levels and toured the country, getting his peasant following, his left-wing communal communist following, to hit the streets and blockade Mexican centers of business and industry. He refused to accept the vote of the people. And so there you have it. That's what happened. Now, if those of you who haven't been to Mexico City, you do know, you've seen pictures of this huge plaza, the Zócalo, it's called, and where the National Palace is and the National Cathedral. And so if you draw, that's in downtown Mexico City. If you draw a circle around the Zócalo, say 5 miles, a radius of 5 miles, you draw that circle, and what you have is the heart of the Mexico City business district, which is huge, but it's a huge city. It's a huge country, remember, 120 some odd million people. So if you draw this circle, and then that's the center of Mexican business, and then you flood it with peasants to block the traffic and don't allow businesses to open, you cause great harm to the country. And that's what AMLO's people did in 2006. They cost the country of Mexico billions of dollars in business, billions of dollars in taxes, and practically brought the country down. That is AMLO. He finally gave up, but he never apologized for wounding the country like he did so deeply and so profoundly. And now he's president. So, AMLO is calling for the ex-presidents Calderón and Peña Nieto, who AMLO took over from in December of 2018. He wants them, he's demanding that they testify that they or their appointees were corrupt. Give us a break. There's no Fifth Amendment in Mexico like we have. Anyway, it takes brass balls for AMLO to make that demand, because we know that if we wanted to, if the government wanted to, they could go back to when he was governor of the state of Tabasco and find all kinds of corruption, because he was a PRI guy then. And the PRI is, as Vicente Fox said, el PRI es el corrupción es el PRI. The PRI is corruption, and corruption is the PRI. That was AMLO, governor. He was a corrupt governor, period. So what you have here is Emilio Lozoya, who is the former head of the world's most failed national oil company, Pemex, has told AMLO political appointees, the attorney general, that millions of dollars in bribes were paid by a Brazilian company to so that they would get contracts worth billions of dollars from the Mexican government. AMLO, quote, the attorney general has disclosed that two ex-presidents are involved in possible acts of corruption, also public servants, legislators. So what comes next is that they should be called to give evidence, and Mr. Lozoya should present proof. AMLO states he wants to demolish the neoliberal agenda. This goes back to the American tradition in recent years of accusing people like me of being neocons. Like, that's a nasty phrase. That's what he's saying to private enterprise people in Mexico. He's calling them neoliberals. Like the idiot knows what that even means. He is like the despicable American phonies who labeled neocons neocons, which originally started as people, conservative Jews, who became conservatives on the Republican side. They grew up as liberals in the Democratic tradition, in the Democratic Party tradition, but because of foreign affairs, they took a hard, for example, supporting Israel. Jews that don't support Israel are acceptable to the Democratic Party much more than Jews who defend Israel, for example. Anyway, AMLO is nothing more than a wannabe communist dictator of a country in which there is no private enterprise. That's his goal. And he wants to do that. And the brewery situation in Mexicali is a perfect example. He wants to turn the country back to the days of President Lázaro Cárdenas, who confiscated land, private land, and gave it away to local communes, to local groups of Indians who knew how to grow corn but didn't know how to sell it, didn't know how to do it. And that experiment, the Mexican commune system, failed, and it almost took the country into total historical financial ruin. I'll discuss land confiscation by Cárdenas in a moment. Experts wonder at the timing of Emilio Lozoya's extradition from Spain. Was it just to take the nation's attention away from the pandemic? He was fighting extradition, but it never went to court because one day he just decided to quit fighting. No, it wasn't a gimme that he was going to get extradited. If he had allegedly had the millions of dollars that he was charged with accepting in the form of bribes, he could fight it forever. Come on, Spanish courts are no different than any other courts. You got enough money, you can get your way. AMLO is deflecting. He has totally failed in leading the country through the pandemic that has killed so many Mexicans. Remember, Mexico now is number 3 in the number of deaths caused by the pandemic, by the COVID-19 virus. Okay? United States is number 1 under President Trump. That's his great achievement. Number 2 is Brazil, which has a president just like Donald Trump named Bolsonaro. And Mexico is number 3. Now remember, Italy and France and Germany and Great Britain and all the troubles they had a few months ago, Mexico's passed them by like they were standing still. Trump flubbed up his entire administration because his leadership during the pandemic has proved to be terrible. AMLO is the same in Mexico. In the United States, 160,000 people so far have died. And that will be, by Election Day in November, probably be 200,000. And President Trump says, like AMLO says, it is what it is, quote unquote. Now, former ambassador to the United States, Arturo Sarucan, says, quote, while it's essential that endemic corruption be confronted and uprooted, this is manna from heaven for López Obrador. That's this, meaning Emilio Lozoya's testimony. For López Obrador, as a distraction from the COVID-19 pandemic and the state of the Mexican economy, which has been struggling through the pandemic. Quote, on the Lozoya corruption charges, he says, quote, we still haven't seen proof in the pudding. We are getting leaks from what Lozoya is allegedly telling the prosecutor's office, but we don't have a smoking gun yet. Not even close, Mr. Ambassador. Now, I said a few minutes ago about Lázaro Cárdenas, who stole millions and millions of acres of land in the 1930s and handed them over to local communities for free, and then had the government subsidize their farming. And the problem with it was, for example, let's say a village had 100 men, okay? 100 men. So the communal property was divided up into 100 parcels originally. And then what happened was, then, as each man had a family, let's say he had 2 sons, then that parcel that started off, that parcel for one man, was cut up, and so now it was 3 parcels. Well, as they kept, and rural Mexico in those days had, you know, like an average of 7 kids per family, so let's assume that half of them were 3.5 to 4 were boys. So an original parcel would wind up 20 years later or 30 years later, instead of one owner for one parcel, you had 5 owners for one parcel. And naturally, the production fell off. You cannot grow corn or beans or whatever. As it is, Mexico imports like 80% of its beans. It imports rice. It imports corn. The birthplace of corn imports corn from the United States because it's cheaper than trying to grow it in Mexico. Okay, so here we have an Indian tribe in northern Mexico, in the state of Sonora, which is immediately south of the state of Arizona in the United States. The Yaqui Indians roamed across the border for all those years, leading up to 1910 when the revolution occurred. And they wound up, a reservation of them was appointed or carved out for them in the Tucson area of Arizona because they were, it was a trans-border Indian tribe. And so you had these Mexican Indians and American Indians. Finally, they got a reservation in outside of Tucson. But Tucson grew over the years. Remember, Arizona didn't even become a state till 1912. So Tucson grew over the years and surrounds the casino. The casino is right in the middle of a modern metropolitan city in Arizona. Well, what else is there to do in Arizona at night? The casino. They don't have to go to Las Vegas anymore. And so the Yaqui Indians of Tucson are filthy rich. Anyway, in Mexico, they had their land. Now, according to my grandfather, two things. He says that his great-great-grandmother, the mother of his grandmother, was a Yaqui Indian that our German immigrant great-great-grandfather of my grandfather, Holman, Mr. Holman, H-O-L-M-A-N, who came from Germany after the Revolution of 1848 failed in Germany and throughout a lot of Europe. And he came to Mexico and wound up in a town called San Jose del Cabo, which is where the airport is now for Cabo San Lucas in Baja California del Sur, about 100 kilometers from the capital, La Paz, which was founded by Hernando Cortes in the 1500s, right after he took Mexico City. My grandfather says that his great-grandfather, that's the father of his grandfather, Holman, married a 100% Yaqui woman, okay? On the Sonora side, before he went to San Jose del Cabo. Anyway, he married her in Sonora. So according to my grandfather, the Contreras line of men have, and women, have Yaqui Indian blood. Now, it is my understanding, I have never read anywhere in over the years of looking into this, that the Yaqui Indians were defeated by the Mexican government or by the United States government. As a matter of fact, what happened in the under Porfirio Diaz, the dictator, at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, is when Yaqui Indians were captured, they were sold into slavery and taken from Sonora, from the desert, to Yucatan to work in the sisal fields, the plantations there. And they were sold for like a dollar a piece. And that was the only way they could actually kill off the Yaqui Indians instead of just butchering them. And so they sold them into slavery. But again, according to my grandfather and according to history, as I've been able to discover it over the years, the Yaqui Indians were never, never defeated. Okay, so what happened was in the 1910 civil war that broke out. It wasn't a revolution. It was a civil war, ladies and gentlemen, between parts of Mexico against other parts of Mexico. And what happened was that the Yaqui Indians made joined Pancho Villa's troops and were part of the División del Norte, the Northern Division, and were instrumental in ending the dictatorship, the very dictatorship that would capture them and sell them into slavery. Well, everything was fine until President Lázaro Cárdenas took over in 1934, and he wanted to turn Mexico into a communist state, and with everybody owning land and taking it away from individuals and giving it to villages and Indian tribes. And so that's what he did. The Yaquis didn't like it. And so recently, among other things, they have risen and they've shut down highways, they've shut down train service, they've interfered with the normal goings-on, the economic goings-on in Sonora, and they haven't started shooting yet, but they could, but they haven't, and they're just using boycotts and highway blockages and thing and the train blockages to bring their issues to the attention of López Obrador. Well, he showed up to one of the into Yaqui territory with a bunch of government ministers, and he promised the Yaquis that he would straighten things out and bring things back to what the Yaquis consider normal, including he wants to revert, he wants to take back land from communes and give it back to the Yaqui villages. That's how much power that they're exercising or implementing in the state of Sonora. Now, again, now my grandfather was very fond of telling his stories, but he knew the grandmother, his grandmother, who was allegedly half Yaqui, which made him part Yaqui and makes me part Yaqui, although it's very small by the time it gets to me. Now, I paid $100 to get a DNA test because I was curious, and I wound up with 49% European white and 49% Mexican, American indigenous, Western Hemisphere indigenous, two bloodlines, Incan or Peruvian, and going back 77 generations, and then in the 44th generation, it switched from heavily Incan to Mexican and Mexican Indian. And I don't know which Mexican tribe. The DNA test doesn't give you down specific breakdowns about that, because Mexican Indians were, you know, I'll tell you in a few minutes when we do the Spanish colonial era, how many Indians there were in the Spanish colonial era. And we'll discuss that in greater detail. But again, taking my grandfather at his word, I am part Yaqui, and I am very proud of that. And the Yaquis in Sonora today, in 2020, are raising hell. Thank goodness. Because Mexico has, of all the Indians in the Western Hemisphere today, 48% live in Mexico. It has the largest Indian population in the Western Hemisphere. Speaking of Indians, the Maya. The Maya was a tribe in the Yucatan Peninsula area and in northern Guatemala. And when López Obrador became president, he had a consultation and had the people of five states, starting with Tabasco, where he was governor, through Yucatan and Quintana Roo. He had them do a consultation, and they approved a project that he has put forth as a big public works thing called the Maya Train. 1,500 kilometers long. They've started construction on it now. And it's being managed. The construction is being managed by the National Tourism, FONATUR. FONATUR is the acronym for it. And they're managing the construction project. And it's the funny thing. They, a couple months ago, announced that the system, the entire 1,500 kilometers, would be powered by diesel locomotives. Well, experts said, what are you doing? Mexico does not produce enough diesel today to meet its domestic supply demands. And now you're going to add a train that's going to be all diesel, and Mexico was going to have to import diesel from Texas. Very expensive diesel compared to locally produced. And you're going to raise the cost of maintenance and the actual operational cost. of this 1,500 kilometer train. So Fonatur took another look at it, said, up. Half of it, it's in seven units, the 1,500, about 200 kilometers a unit, roughly, and that the rail system will be, and it's being constructed in segments. And they, Fonatur has announced that half of the system will be electrical and half will be diesel. So there you go. It's going to add, making a half electrical, about 25 billion pesos, that's US 1.1 billion, to the project's cost. But maintenance and fuel costs will be less over the long term, so it will balance out. Note, the train runs through the state of, starts in the state of Tabasco, AMLO's home state. He says that these five states are the poorest part of Mexico, true, except for Oaxaca, and they're going to build up the tourism business with this train, that tourists will take this train. AMLO says the project will employ 80,000 people this year in 2020 and will create 150,000 jobs, total jobs, in 2021. We shall see. But speaking of the train, the Maya train, which ends in Quintana Roo and comes through Yucatan into Quintana Roo, the states of, we got some news. In Quintana Roo, the governor there, Governor Carlos Joaquin Gonzalez, says the state municipalities of Cancun, Puerto Morelos, Solidaridad, in which Playa Carmen is, Cozumel, Isla Mujeres, Tulum, and Lázaro Cárdenas are all on the brink of returning to normal. In other words, all these hotels on the Mexican Riviera, on those fabulous beaches, are getting ready to open up again. They'll open up slowly, starting in a few days, and start building up towards the season, which basically starts in November, latter part of October, and runs through April or May. Don't plan to go to the Mexican Riviera in June and July and August or September. The humidity will kill you. Anyway, now, next door, that's in the state of Quintana Roo. Now, if you look at a map of Mexico, you see the Yucatan Peninsula sticking up there, going to within 90 miles of Cuba. And the northern part is the state of Yucatan. The southern part, next to the former British Honduras, called Belize. And that part is called Quintana Roo. And that's where these municipalities are that I just mentioned that are planning to open up. Next door in the state of Yucatan, next to Quintana Roo, there has been a prohibition on liquor sales for several months now, because the Governor Mauricio Villa Dosal says, quote, in the face of the coronavirus pandemic, we're looking to avoid mobility, unnecessary social interaction, and gatherings that don't help protect from the virus and contribute to the relaxation of disease prevention measures. Well, the governor is extending the prohibition, which was scheduled to end in August, into September. If anyone violates this, the penalty is up to 6 years in prison and a fine of 17,376 pesos, which is about 776 American dollars. So there. And if you don't want to drink, you can go to Yucatan. If you want to drink right now, you're going to have to suffer through some prohibition, just like the United States did in 1919. Okay. In previous issues of the Business Mexico Report, I've discussed Mexican history. First, we start off with pre-Columbian Indians, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, the capital Tenochtitlan, and how they welcomed Hernando Cortes and his invasion force of 200 that of mercenaries that he gathered up in Cuba and brought in 1519 to Mexico. And then how his group grew to about 500 plus the allies that he put together with Indian tribes in and around the Aztec Empire that hated the Aztecs because for a number of reasons that they paid tribute to. Anyway, they joined Cortez and they ended the Aztec Empire in 1521. Then we're now going to discuss, and last time we discussed the actual Spanish conquest and how he defeated Hernando Cortez and his mercenaries and Indian allies actually defeated the Aztec Empire and now entered the Spanish colonial period. So what we have is 300 years of the Spanish colonial era. It started in 1521. The new territories that Spain claimed extended through most of Central America and much of the south and west of what is now the United States. Apart from establishing military and economic control, the Spanish also embarked on converting the local population to the Roman Catholic religion. What's important here is that there was an eyewitness, a priest, a friar named Bernal Diaz, who wrote a book on the conquest of Mexico by Cortez and the early Spanish colonial era. And so we know from eyewitness reports of what was going on, and that's what makes the history so detailed, that Bernal Diaz put it all down on paper for the world to read. Between 1521 and 1650, the Indian population was heavily reduced, largely as a result of fighting, warfare, and diseases brought by the Spaniards against which the Indians had no defenses. And then there was the destructive effects of colonization on their way of life. The Spanish population grew during that time. Now, as I recall from my History of Mexico class at San Diego State, the Council of the Indies was appointed by the Spanish royalty to run the affairs of the Western Hemisphere, of the Spanish Western Hemisphere. Remember, this was all done 100 years before the English showed up in Virginia. 100 years. Remember that. And so what you have is this Council of Indies determined everything that went on politically and state-wise in the Western Hemisphere. And it was all run out of Seville, and in fact, from Seville and Cadiz, the port for Seville, that all transportation and from Spain to the West, to the Western Hemisphere, was run out of the port of Cadiz. They had tight control. Now, as I recall from Dr. Abraham Nazatir's lectures, the Council of the Indies didn't let Spanish women immigrate to the colonies for 10 years. So if you're wondering why the Spanish men and the Mexican Indian women got together rather rapidly and extensively, that's why, because Spanish women weren't permitted to go to the colonies for 10 years. And then they were. Now, the Spanish population grew, okay? By 1810, when the War of Independence started against Spain, there were an estimated 6 million inhabitants in New Spain, which was Mexico, of which 60,000 were Spanish born in Spain. They were called peninsulares, people from the peninsula. They ran the show. They were number one. 940,000 were Spanish-born in the territories, that is, criollos, C-R-I-L-L-O-S, creoles. They were 100% Spanish blood, but they were born in the colonies, in New Spain. They were ranked number two. These ranks that I'm telling you were official legal definitions. The Spanish colonial era had 16 legally defined racial classifications. And they were more racially pure conscious than the Nazis were in Germany in the 1930s and 40s. More so than the Nazis. Number one were the Peninsulares that I just described to you, those actually born in Spain. Number two were the Criollos, the Creoles, those born in the colonies of Spanish parents. Then came the Mestizos, which were part white and part Indian. And then blacks and Indians and combinations thereof. 16 total legal definitions. At the very bottom was the Indian. That is the case today. Mexico has a race problem. Some of us recognize it. Some of us don't. About 10% of Mexico today is white. And 60% is mestizo, like me, part Indian, part white. And 30% is Indian, pure Indian. More Indians live in Mexico than any other nation in the Western Hemisphere. 48% of all the Indians in the Western Hemisphere live in Mexico. I just told you the story about the Yaquis. Well, there's no more Aztec tribes, but there's a lot of Indian tribes that are descended from the Aztecs. In any event, okay, so there were 940,000 that were Spanish-born in the territories of Criollos. 3.5 million were indigenous Indians. This was in 1810. And 1.5 million were mestizos, people like me, of mixed Spanish or European and Indian blood. Now, there was little industry in New Spain or in Mexico, but there was mining. In particular, silver was the most sought-after source of wealth. Most of the inhabitants made their living from agriculture and raising livestock. Raising livestock, we're talking about ranchos and haciendas. The Spanish farmed large properties called haciendas, while the Indian population worked small plots or as serfs on lands owned by their Spanish lords. But what happened was there was little industry, but there was lots of mining. There's a great story of a Spanish explorer. He started a campfire to cook dinner for he and his men. And the heat from the fire melted pure silver that he built the fire on that he thought were just rocks. And the silver was running down, and that's how silver was discovered in Taxco. That's the legend. I don't know how accurate it is. Taxco is a town and about 100 kilometers from Mexico City that at one time was the world capital of silver mining. Mexico today is the number one silver producer in the world. Silver is very important for our electronic lifestyle, and it's all in all of our phones and stuff. Anyway, the Taxco, this guy who became fabulously rich, he built the cathedral. You can go to it now in Taxco, and it's fabulous, absolutely fabulous to this day. If you ever get down there, go to Taxco. It's about 100 kilometers from Mexico City, and you'll thoroughly enjoy it. It's a little tourist town built up in the mountains, and you can get there by bus. When the first time I went there, let me see, the first time I went there, I went by bus with my little brother when I took him for a 30-day trip into Mexico as a gift for his graduation from high school after the 11th grade because he skipped the 12th grade. Anyway, and then when I got married, we stopped in Taxco for a couple of days on my honeymoon, and I drove there that time. I had to rent a car. And my wife and I were kept awake all night, New Year's Eve, by a bunch of drunk Mexicans in the plaza below our window there of the Hotel Real de Taxco. And they were singing melancholy songs with guitars and carrying on. Totally sad, even though it was New Year's Eve. And fireworks and people dancing and making all kinds of noise kept us up half the night. But anyway, if you ever get down there, make sure you go to Taxco. The Spanish also controlled commerce. The main products were silver, sugar, cacao, cocoa. Remember, chocolate came from Mexico. Hides from the ranchos and fine woods. Now, the ranchos and haciendas, the Spanish were too good to actually run them on a day-to-day basis. So that's where the mestizos came in. These are people who spoke Spanish and could deal with Indian workers, and because they were part Indian, and they spoke usually the Indian language too, the local Indian language. And they invented the cowboy. It wasn't the Spanish, it was the mestizo Mexican. Because the Spanish hired the mestizos to be their foremen and to run their ranches and to run their haciendas. That was too much dirty work for the Spanish. They want to be Spanish grandees because in Spain they were nothing. They were, well, they were a little bit of something. But they were, you know, long-lost cousins of the royal families and stuff like that. But in the New World, they were hot stuff. They were number one. You couldn't be a priest if you were a mestizo. You had to be either a peninsulare or a criollo. You couldn't be a government functionary unless you were number one or number two. You couldn't be a mestizo. So when the War of Independence broke out, it had a deep, deep racial component to it. So they controlled sugar, silver, cacao, hides, and fine woods. The only manufacturing really developed during the period was the textile industry based on cotton. Okay? Based on cotton. Now, in the United States, the textile industry first grew up in New England. Remember that? And then that shut down and they moved to the American South. Then that shut down and they moved to Mexico. So this business in the NAFTA debate that, well, Mexico has stolen all these jobs. Yeah, it's part of a natural process. The textile industry is perfect. Mexico for a while was the world's leading textile producer back in the 60s. And then China came along after the Nixon visit, and now they're number one. So that is the Spanish colonial period. It lasted for 300 years. Now, one of the things, a friend of mine who lives part-time in Puerto Vallarta and part-time in Las Vegas was a big connoisseur of tequila. And he visited the distilleries in tequila. They have tasting rooms in the town of Tequila, which is in the state of Jalisco, and it's an hour or so outside of Guadalajara. It's the heart of the tequila industry. All tequila is made in Mexico. Anything you say that's called itself tequila that's made elsewhere is not tequila, okay? Because it can only come from one type of cactus. Anyway, and that's grown there in Mexico, that part of Mexico. And so anyway, he laughingly told me one time that he was making the rounds of the distilleries and the tequila tasting rooms when he came upon this one distillery that had a big sign at the entrance that said, "This company, this distillery, was 200 years old when George Washington was born in America. It started in 1540 or 1530. And it's still in business today in 2020. That's the Spanish colonial period. Remember that. It lasted until 1810. So next time we'll discuss the War of Independence and how it took 10 years, and it was started by a priest who was a criollo, and he led the fight and started the fight. He didn't lead it because he was killed right away, but he started the fight. Mexico is better for it. It took 10 years to drive the Spanish out, but what happened in 1822 was the newly declared Mexican Empire ranged from Sonoma in what is now California on the north to Panama in the south. The Mexican Empire in 1822 was the second largest empire in the entire world. Okay, that's it for today. Again, I thank you for being there. By the way, my email address is Hispanic Commentator. That's one word, two C's, two M's, Hispanic Commentator at gmail.com. gmail.com. You want to send me a note? Please do so. Question, note, you want to criticize me? Go ahead. I don't care. I've got very thick skin. I've been doing this for a long time. So, HispanicCommentator@gmail. Again, this is the Contreras Report, Business Mexico. I am Raul Lowry Contreras. I am thrilled to be here again and will be here in a few days for issue number 113. This is Business Report, issue 112. Thank you so much for being there, and I look forward to doing this again in a few days.